I'm your host, Jared Holt. Today is June 10th, 2019. In this episode, we're talking to reporters Ryan Broderick and Alex Thomas. Shitpost is a podcast at the intersection of online culture and politics. It's supported by listeners like you at Substack.com. There, for $5 a month or $50 a year, you can help what we're doing here and receive access to weekly newsletters and some occasional bonus audio content. Join the discussion on Discord and call our voicemail inbox at 202-630-0580. And that was the plug right off the top. There wasn't a shitpost last week because I was on vacation in the Bahamas. And let me tell you, folks, it was relaxing. I swam with some sea turtles. I ate some conch, which is like a little snail thing inside those big shells. I did some diving. It was good. And then I came back to the United States and connected to the internet, and oh man, things really caught fire, to say the least, when I was away. Today we're going to try to get to some of the more salient parts of the shakeups that we saw over the last week, and of course, that means we're talking about YouTube. And before I get into everything, yesterday I streamed with The Serfs on YouTube, so check it out. They do some really great work. It was a fun conversation. And with that, let's go to the news. On Tuesday, while I was on a boat cruising around the Atlantic Ocean, the internet went crazy at news that Boston would supposedly hold a straight pride parade for straight people who claim that they are quote-unquote an oppressed majority. This story is coming out of the Daily Beast. So while the idea of, you know, a few dozen like angry straight people marching, you know, seems like funny, it's funny, right? It was like mocked and sort of panned online. It turns out the thing was being organized by a far-right group that was founded by Based Stickman, a.k.a. Kyle Chapman. This is a guy who achieved online notoriety in the right for beating a anti-fascist protester, multiple, I think, with a stick he was holding. It's not clear that this parade, this straight pride parade, is even going to happen, really. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the group that is organizing this is kind of notorious in the Boston area for not really being able to get everything together and pull off an event. Last year in August, the same group, they tried to organize a national march against far-left violence. But the group kind of got fucked up because the page links to a website that had like free t-shirts for people who were going to go. And it was later revealed to be an anti-fascist sting. It doxed a ton of people who had planned to go to this event. So I guess we're going to see if Boston has a straight pride parade after all. Some other developing stuff is that they were going to appoint Milo Yiannopoulos as the marshal for this parade, and that's caused some infighting among organizers and planned participants of the parade who, you know, believe it or not, these folks at a straight pride parade might not take so kindly as to having a openly gay man as their marshal. Speaking of, Milo published this big expose on his website today. I might put an archive in the show links. I was saying today that, you know, Milo has been effectively deplatformed off most of the internet. He's been cut off of his Mercer funding. The show's over for him, so I'm hesitant to even give him too much play or read in too much to anything he published. But he's vindictive right now. He is sort of punching right among the circles that he was once friendly in. He's published this big expose on his website alleging that the filmmaker for Lauren Southern had defrauded Alex Jones, had faked a rape allegation, had been feeding information to anti-fascist groups, had overcharged conservative activists. I mean, it's a laundry list of accusations, and I don't know if any of them are true. But what I do know is that this article has sort of set off a wave of both public and behind-the-scenes backstabbing, infighting. People are, it's causing quite a stir and commotion in right-wing press. Which brings us to the next bit of news, which is that Lauren Southern announced that she was stepping away from public life. Lauren Southern published a blog post last week announcing that she had plans to pursue a, quote, less public life. Lauren Southern first became prominent in the U.S. with her work at The Rebel Media. That's where I first picked up on her. I think one of the first things I encountered content-wise that she had produced was the interview with a MGTOW activist, and it's just so bizarre and weird. She attended Unite the Right in Charlottesville and has slowly or not so slowly, maybe slowly is fair, has evolved into this sort of talking head for watered down white nationalism and sometimes not so watered down and anti-immigrant rhetoric in, you know, the broader political discourse. Last year, she released a documentary that we've talked about on this show before with a South African nationalist group, and it essentially served to further a narrative about quote-unquote white genocide in South Africa. White genocide is not happening in South Africa. It is a white nationalist conspiracy theory dating back to the end of apartheid. And in that pursuit, even went so far in that documentary to go to a whites-only territory in South Africa, town in South Africa, and sort of proposed that as some sort of solution to farm murders that are happening in the country. So real nasty racist shit. I don't think that anything will be missing from political discourse as she steps down, but it did seem kind of sudden. And if this Milo article, you know, the way it's getting passed around and chatted about in right-wing circles, if there's any veracity to it, even just a little bit, the parts where Lauren Southern's involved, it may have a couple clues as to why we saw a very sudden departure from her. 3 months ago, I wrote about Linda Collins-Smith. She's a politician that I knew of quite well. I am from Arkansas, and she was a state senator in Arkansas for quite a bit of time. That's why I was surprised, or if I'm being totally honest, not surprised at all, that she called into a QAnon YouTube channel a few months ago. I wrote about that in a piece for Right Wing Watch at the time. She didn't speak about QAnon directly during that YouTube show, but her appearance was another instance of this sort of intersection we see seemingly more and more between the conspiratorial, sort of eccentric, to be polite about it, parts of right-wing media overlapping with people that hold real power in the Republican Party in the United States. On June 4th, she was found dead, and her death is being investigated as a murder. But because she had briefly overlapped with the QAnon conspiracy zeitgeist online, she became the subject of multiple conspiracy theories post-mortem. To folks who believe in QAnon, Linda Collins-Smith's suspected murder was another instance of retaliation from the deep state. Or maybe it was the Clinton cabal. Or maybe both of those work together, and, you know, depending on which QAnon believers you're listening to and which parts of the forums you're reading, it could be anything. But it's just like another example we saw with Isaac Cappy, sort of C-list actor that apparently committed suicide. You know, nothing is sacred in this community. It's truly psychotic. Although I was certainly not a fan of Linda Collins-Smith's politics, either when she was in office or the work she continued to do after, it still does make me a little sick to my stomach to watch this go down. And now for the big topic of this episode, YouTube.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
The latest installment of chaos surrounding the digital pit fire that YouTube has become started on May 30th when Vox journalist Carlos Maza complained about a years-long pattern of bullying that he had experienced at the hands of comedian, and I use that term so lightly, Stephen Crowder. And Stephen Crowder is one of YouTube's larger political content creators. That's going to be important to remember as we go through this mess. Crowder had targeted Mazza with numerous insults about his sexual orientation and ethnicity, calling him, among other things, a lispy queer. Crowder is a self-styled conservative comedian, and I use that loosely because I think he's painfully unfunny. Crowder began in sort of the Fox News, CPAC circuit, promoting himself as this conservative comedian, but he wasn't really funny enough to stick around for too long, and a few of his things got a little too edgy for him to keep going on TV. But on YouTube, his show throughout the years, with its racist characters of racial minorities and digs against Jews, women, essentially any group that is not like white dudes, has flourished. When criticized, Crowder and his allies hide under this veil of comedy, irony, sarcasm. But Crowder's a little harder to write off just because he's hosted a slew of influential GOP figures like, not so long ago, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas. 4 days after Mazza originally, called out YouTube for failing to respond to Crowder's sort of ongoing bullying against him and how that had violated the platform's harassment policies, YouTube responded. But that was hardly the end of it. On Tuesday, YouTube said that Crowder hadn't violated the platform's bullying policies. On Wednesday, Crowder was forbidden from selling ads against his videos because he did violate the policies. YouTube said that Crowder's demonetization could be revoked if he, quote, addressed all the issues with his channel, which included removing links to a web store where he sells a shirt that includes the slogan, "Socialism is for figs," except it is not.
Is a fig a fruit?
We're not talking about the fruit. It was the slur used against gay people. To make matters even worse, a day after they said that Crowder had not violated the policies, YouTube rolled out a long-planned policy designed to more aggressively combat white supremacist content on its website. Videos with this content were removed, channels were demonetized, and I think someone was counting, it was around 5, maybe 6 YouTube channels had been outright banned. The policy had been in development for quite some time, but when it rolled out, it really kicked up a fire on YouTube, especially when it led to some creators who produce content that critique and expose white supremacist content receiving the same penalties as if they had produced it themselves. The YouTube community blamed Fox and Carlos Mazza for YouTube's new policy, and YouTube would only tell journalists off the record that the policy was unrelated to Mazza's complaint. They didn't tell me that, and I didn't agree to go off the record, so I'm telling you all that now. So shame on YouTube. I suppose that maybe YouTube thought that Mazza could take the heat for this policy, which anytime demonetization happens systematically on YouTube, there's criticism. But that's pretty disgusting, in my opinion. Instead, Mazza received even more targeted harassment as he was in the middle of a harassment storm. The whole situation, start to finish, has been an absolute mess, and inside and out of YouTube, people are furious. Within Google, employees who spoke to tech outlet The Verge say that they feel frustration, anger, and exhaustion over what they see as a recurring problem at YouTube, especially for the LGBTQ community. Google employees have consistently said to outlets like The Verge that they're afraid to speak up or voice too much criticism about issues that matter to them. Employees have been doxxed to far-right sites by their colleagues for being outspoken on diversity, for example. The way that YouTube handled this whole situation has been an absolute mess. It's hard to disagree with that, no matter if you're complaining that YouTube should not be demonetizing content, or if you're on the other side of saying it should enforce its rules more consistently. I think we can all generally agree that YouTube really fucked this one up. But I have a couple takeaways about sort of the situation in general. So in order to make this argument that YouTube has a right to remove content, you also have to simultaneously acknowledge that YouTube has the choice to keep content on its site. There's nothing authoritarian about seeking an explanation when the stated values of a corporation doesn't match its actions. If YouTube is going to promote itself as a space that's encouraging and safe and welcoming to the LGBTQ community, they can't, you know, the people will expect them to behave in certain ways to protect that community against those who wish it ill. So demanding action or demanding accountability is not authoritarian. It's exactly what we should be doing to corporations, especially one as huge as YouTube. And that really gets to the heart of the issue, which is the bigger picture critique. YouTube, which is owned by Google, has sucked up so much online real estate that it doesn't have an actual motivation to hold true to public promises it makes to the LGBTQ community or other communities for that matter. Thus, we see piecemeal remedies that are sort of designed to tamper down PR nightmares instead of systemic solutions to the problems that it faces. Irene Kapp, a Google senior software engineer, told The Verge this, and I think it sums it up really well. Quote, "The company takes half measures and pats itself on the back for those half measures." Unquote. Walk us through exactly what went wrong with this latest policy rollout targeting white supremacist content and sort of the ongoing pit fire that is brewing around Carlos Maza's criticisms of Steven Crowder. We have BuzzFeed News senior reporter Ryan Broderick joining Shitpost now. Joining Shitpost now is Ryan Broderick. He's a senior reporter at BuzzFeed News, and he's been covering this pit fire of YouTube hell. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, I've been running it down, and this has not been a great week for YouTube by many accounts. As we sit now, we're recording this on Sunday, a lot of people are finding themselves not satisfied with how YouTube responded. So my question for you is, after everything that happened this week, what went wrong and why are people so frustrated right now?
Oh boy. So, I mean, an easier question is what do you think actually went right? But I mean, so the biggest issue is that this is a complicated, controversial policy change. You know, after a lot of hemming and hawing about how they would start moderating, you know, hateful, discriminatory content, YouTube decides they're going to launch this thing 24 hours after saying that they probably weren't going to do anything about it. They didn't give journalists much heads up at all. I mean, most tech reporters were kind of told like something's going to happen tomorrow, but we weren't sure what it was. And then when they did announce the policy change, it was really unclear what it even was. You know, they used the word prohibit. And I remember we were having a discussion in our newsroom being like, what does that mean? Are they blocking stuff? Are they banning stuff? You know, and then as we see them actually roll this thing out on Wednesday, I guess it was, a million years ago. So they didn't seem to know how to even enforce their own policy. So it was pandemonium. I mean, and every time, an account would announce they were demonetized or the very few that were banned would pop up, we'd reach out, you know, for comment again, and I still haven't had any clarification from YouTube's side about what they are doing or how this will even continue after this week. So that would be my biggest criticism of the whole thing.
Yeah, so it doesn't seem very consistent. You know, when it came to this ban that they said was aimed at, you know, white supremacist content, at Right Wing Watch, we got a video pulled, and the original is still up. It doesn't seem to be consistently or transparently enforced, which I think is just kind of like the hallmark of like the frustrations people have had with YouTube over the years, is this lack of transparency, this lack of consistency, and it's just like so difficult to get a human if you're a creator. So in the creator community, there's a bit of a meltdown happening. Generally speaking, from what you've seen, how is this being received?
People are frustrated. I mean, there were a lot of channels that were, demonetized that aren't particularly savory. You know, it's like some pretty hateful, some pretty rough, channels. and they're tweeting about how frustrated they are. And, you know, part of me ironically was like, yeah, like, you know, fine. Like, I get why you're pissed. I mean, and it's because, like, I don't really get the sense that YouTube understands the extent of kind of the rot inside of their community. I don't think they really understand how their algorithms work. You know, a lot of the big, you know, big time, you know, extremist channels like Lauren Southern's, for instance, doesn't appear to be affected at all. So it just seemed very random. And I think the very kind of like surface level scan they did on Wednesday and started removing videos or demonetizing channels, when that happened, it felt insanely random, which kind of, I think, added to the paranoia and confusion, because no one could figure out why any of this was happening. It seemed to be based on really surface level, like metadata scans from some AI that was just like, okay, you have Nazi in the title, you can't have any more money from us. And you know, it's like, and you know, Nazi creators aren't tagging their stuff like neo-Nazism. Like Red Ice doesn't even do that. And I think they were eventually demonetized, but the fact that they're still even up is like mind blowing to me. So it just didn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I mean, it kind of goes back, like, this does not solve that core rot that you mentioned. You know, the YouTube community has these, like, almost fundamental systemic issues that it's dealing with. If there was just going to be, like, if we can spark notes this real fast, it might be helpful. But essentially, from what I gather, it's just, like, the whole site is designed to incentivize you know, more intense and more extreme content. Is that what you've been seeing, or is there more that we should be cognizant of?
I mean, the way I think about it is, like, AIs, artificial intelligence and algorithms, they don't have morality. They don't really understand anything beyond, like, you know, inputs and outputs, right? So, you know, YouTube, a couple years ago, they switched to time on site metrics and engagement as, like, the thing that they really care about. They design a little robot inside of their website that says, okay, I'll do everything in my power to keep people more engaged, keep people on the website longer. And then the robot figured out that a really simple way to do that is to get people really angry and really fired up and really paranoid and crazy. And the way that that seems to manifest is usually with really intense, conspiratorial and fascist and racist and sexist and homophobic content, because it gets people who agree with it and people who don't agree with it to get really, really engaged with it. So, I mean, that's sort of the place that I'm always coming from with this stuff, is that, like, I don't think, you know, the recommendation algorithm is poisoned. It's just that it's not sophisticated enough to understand what it's doing, because it's, you know, it's like an automated series of levers. So, you know, it's like getting mad at the slot machine and not the person who designed the slot machine. You know what I mean?
Right.
Except this slot machine just turns your uncle or 14-year-old little brother into a Nazi.
Yeah. And like, in turn, if you are a full-time creator on YouTube, you know, and you're making money from this, you're trying to follow the metrics, follow the audience. So, like, as that situation bubbles up on the website, you know, these creators are incentivized to make more intense, more sort of outrage bait type content. But so whether it's this latest push that we've seen with this new policy, or pushes in the past, do you think YouTube's making a good faith effort here to try to improve its site?
good faith. I think the way I
do you want me to rephrase that?
No, not at all. I think it's important, because, like, that's like how we kind of think about these things, right? Is like, is the company trying? And I actually do think YouTube is trying. I think the problem is that they're coming from a place of such, like, lack of context and understanding of their own platform, that even if they do try, it's like they're not playing with a full deck of cards with this, you know? Like, like, the rollout is a perfect example where, like, if they understood their community, they would have known that a multi-update live rollout with, you know, bits and pieces dropped here and there would be, you know, perfect breadcrumbs for like the YouTube drama machine and turn their entire thing this week into a circus. If they had any understanding of like how their community operates, which, you know, as you said, kind of funnels back into the incentives that they created with their algorithms, like they wouldn't have done anything they did this week. So, you know, I do think that they have, at least the first step is acknowledging you have a problem. They seem to, to acknowledge that now, that they're like, okay, yes, there are a bunch of white supremacists on our website and we should probably figure out how to do something about that. I also do take them at their word when they say like, look, this is a free speech issue. We have to be really careful about the precedents we set. And I think you can take them seriously because they're not the first company to go through this. I mean, you think about like the Hollywood system with the MPAA like 100 years ago, or the comic book code, you know, because up until the comic book code, they were just printing whatever they wanted. And then like the, you know, a panel of like outraged Christian moms, like we're going to be like, we're going to ban comic books. And then they created the comic book code, which created about 30 or 40 years of pretty weird standards for comic books. I think we're seeing the same thing here with video platforms and social platforms, but YouTube also is at a scale that is like unreal. So every minor change they make isn't different. It isn't like, you know, making Swamp Thing not have a completely naked body or something. It's not like, you know, 50 years ago comic books. It's like any tweak will have massive, massive ramifications for, you know. It's funny, you were talking about creators, and I've been talking this week with a lot of people about, you know, 5 years ago we thought, oh, a YouTuber is a stepping stone to a real entertainer. It's like, oh, I'll get my YouTube channel, and then I'll get a deal with a studio, and I'll make movies or go on TV, and then I won't have to do YouTube anymore. And 5 years later, we've learned that YouTubers are not a stepping stone for something else. They are just a kind of middle-class version of, you know, a TV host or like one of those like desktop buddies that you used to download, or like a Tamagotchi. They're like a virtual friend, right? And so these people are, you know, lower middle class to upper middle class content creators that live and die by these changes. So as YouTube is rolling out all of this stuff, I think everything they do is having just like huge, huge waves of effect. And it's, you know, complicated.
Yeah, very, very complicated. And I guess that takes me, I mean, if you're a content creator, like these little changes, like if you're leaning on a YouTube channel for your living and all of a sudden you're demonetized, you just lost your income, right? So like these are huge changes, and the creator community seems to be going nuts with this latest one. Do we have an idea of like where this is going? Every time this happens, you see alternative platforms. Like there's a few, like BitChute, I think is one of the more prominent ones. VidMe, Vimeo, whatever. They'll try to sort of siphon off creators and encourage them to come over to their platforms. I saw Keemstar tweeted something about like organizing a, like trying to encourage advertising companies to boycott media companies, which I don't think that's going to work.
Oh, man, he's amazing.
Power to him. Do we have any indication, like, what's next?
I mean, I would love for that to happen. I think all of the problems of the last 5 years are because we used to have websites, and we had infinite amounts of websites, and now we don't have infinite amounts of websites. We have four. I think we've gone from, like, you know, an infinitely vast you know, living space to being crammed into four tower blocks, and now everyone is insane and angry at each other. That would be great. It would be super cool if all of a sudden in the wave of this, a bunch of mom and pop video channels appeared, or video platforms appeared, and everyone started using them. And there is a bit of that going on. I mean, TikTok is an interesting space. It gives you a 15-second limit, I think. Maybe close to a minute in some cases. And the editing tools are great. A lot of the young creators I've talked to on those similar kinds of apps say, you know, I don't have the time or the resources to build a YouTube video because that takes, you know, Final Cut or After Effects or Adobe Premiere or whatever. And I'm 14 and I just have my phone. So that's kind of cool. I love that. I thought the death of Vine was like, actually had a worse effect on YouTube than we're probably ready to look at just yet. Mainly because a lot of the bad people from Vine went to YouTube. But I think I think it would be great if that happened. Media diversity, I think, is good. It means that, you know, white nationalists can't easily hijack your shit if it's not all, you know, in one place.
Right.
I don't think that's happening, though. I think we're probably not over the hump yet. I think we're not at peak YouTube yet, if that's even, you know, possible to imagine. I think these conversations that are happening are good. I think the LGBT creators that have come forward and talked about this a lot are good. The reports I'm reading from inside of Google, you know, the gay and, you know, LGBT Google employees talking about this stuff is really good. But I still think YouTube is the biggest player in the game and will be for quite some time. But, you know, maybe this is the start of the diversification. That would be great if this, you know, but I'm not hopeful because I'm, yeah. Yellow, so yeah. I can't be.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be great. But, as a reporter, I've been let down enough to know not to get my hopes up.
I'm a professional pessimist. That's what I get paid for. So.
Yeah. Ryan, before I let you go, is there anything else about this YouTube situation that, you know, maybe hasn't been getting as much play in press or, you know, is an important part of the conversation or something to think about that, you know, you would want listeners to this show to know?
Yeah, I mean, there's something that I've sort of been a little... I think a thing that really bothers me about this rollout is that a company as large as YouTube decided to launch something as complicated and as obviously controversial as it was going to be and focused it directly around one person, right? Like this all sort of started kicking off when the Vox journalist Carlos Maza started, you know, talking about the homophobic harassment he'd received from Steven Crowder. And for a company that large to kind of focus it that way on one person, you know, regardless of your political alignment, your sexual orientation, your job, whatever, if you're one person and all of a sudden you've become the center of what will probably go down as one of the most controversial decisions YouTube has made in the last couple of years with mm-hmm. all kinds of users, you know, like Keemstar, he's taking the side of, you know, God knows what, you know, it's like YouTube,
yeah.
Politically, YouTube is a nightmare. So I can't imagine what it's like to be in the middle of that hellstorm. And it's just like, come on. Like, I don't know. I wish that was being talked about more. Cause I can't imagine what that would be like. And, you know, it's gotta be a pretty scary feeling.
So before we get out of here, let's try to end this on a positive note. Because this is Shitpost, Ryan, what is your favorite meme, viral video, conspiracy theory, or even just a damn good post?
Okay. So, I have been really getting back into popping videos. Are you familiar with this?
No, I'm not. Oh, tell me about this.
Oh man. Okay. So, there's a subreddit called R Popping and it's, like pimple popping, cyst removal.
Oh God, Ryan, like, why?
It's splinter removal. It's like, it's addicting. It's like really therapeutic. I don't know. There's something about it. I recently keep meeting people who like are secret poppers. So perhaps you have some listeners that are also secret poppers, but it's a thing. Give it a shot.
Go check it out. Oh, I'll think that one over. Cool. I'll think about it. All right, Ryan, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
When I got back from vacation, I checked the Shitpost voicemail inbox, the one that you can call at 202-630-0580, and I had a message that I thought was a really great question, so I'm going to do a very short mini-segment on this.
Hey, Jared. I was wondering if I could get an update on James O'Keefe. I haven't heard about him in a very long time, and it's probably a good thing, but I wonder sometimes if him and the whole Project Veritas team is doing anything of note lately. It doesn't seem like it, and I don't want to wake a sleeping giant or whatever rouse a bear. I don't know what the phrase should be. Basically, I'm just wondering. I don't even know if it's worth it. Just asking, because you seem to know about these things. Thanks, bud. Bye.
First off, thanks for calling into the podcast. I love hearing from you guys and being able to interact, you know, directly with y'all. So, to get to your question, if you're getting the impression that Project Veritas has been quiet as of late, you're not wrong. So, for those who don't know, Project Veritas is the project of a right-wing activist named James O'Keefe. O'Keefe and his group are known for deceptively editing videos that they often record undercover, and then they distribute them among right-wing press as fodder to smear left-of-center activist groups or, frankly, whoever's in the crosshairs. In the Trump era, the people in the crosshairs have been the fictional, quote-unquote, deep state, a.k.a. Washington, D.C., DSA members that work in the government. It's been tech companies, this idea of, you know, mass-scale voter fraud, and teachers' unions. On April 24th, O'Keefe published this thing on his website that said Project Veritas was moving in a different direction, enlisting the help of folks like Proud Boys leader, who was demonetized by Chase Bank. And, you know, they're trying to tap just sort of readers, members of the general public to do their dirty work, give them the content. It's a much scrappier approach, and what else did I see? Oh, they're also teasing that they're going to put something out tomorrow. But a lot of this has been on hold, you know, for the past few months, and there's probably multiple reasons for it. One is that they're organizing, they're planning, they're out, you know, getting this video and stuff that they are then going to cut up and push out to the press. But O'Keefe has also been fighting a lawsuit against a guy named Steve Wentz. He's the president of the Wichita Teachers Union. He was the subject of a video that Project Veritas put out in 2016. Steve Wentz said that O'Keefe had illegally recorded him and defamed him by deceptively editing the video. I didn't expect Steve Wentz to get very far with this lawsuit just because First Amendment law is so generous in the United States. And as one would expect, the case was thrown out. And frankly, that's how most defamation cases in the United States end. So Project Veritas has been quiet in recent months, but we certainly haven't seen the last of them. We should expect more aggressive efforts from this group, especially as we head towards the 2020 election. Project Veritas and James O'Keefe are flush with cash, and unfortunately that means they're not going anywhere. And to wrap up Shitpost, this week I have a nice and casual Sunday afternoon conversation with my dear friend Alex Thomas. He spoke to Ed Krasenstein, post-Krasenstein Twitter ban. So, you know, he's got the latest update on the Krasen Bros. What's up with them? What are they doing? What's next? So enjoy this interview with Alex Thomas. Joining Shitpost now, we have Alex Thomas. He's the Washington correspondent for Playboy magazine, everybody's favorite magazine for the articles. But he also writes some freelance work, and he did a piece last week for the Daily Dot about this podcast's favorite dynamic duo, the Krasen Bros, Ed and Brian Krasenstein. Alex, what's up, dude?
Hey, thanks for having me today, Jared.
Yeah, Alex is in the new Shitpost Studios, which instead of my bedroom is my living room. So welcome to the new digs.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Got some hanging laundry, some guitars. Yeah. Nice.
So let's talk about the Krasensteins. So I guess just in case anybody listening to this isn't familiar with the Krasensteins, who are they?
The Krasensteins or the Krasen Bros, whatever you want to call them, are the two best Twitter users that no longer tweet. No, they're just guys that, two 38-year or 37-year-old guys out of Florida they got famous for replying to Trump's tweets immediately with, like, just awesome clapbacks, like, you, sir, are fired. And, like,
damn.
Stuff like that. And they, like, mass followed a ton of people. And they got, like, at the end, when they were banned, they had, like, 1.5 million followers between them. So they had, like, a lot of followers. I've never met anybody that, like, sincerely just geeked out over the Krasensteins, but, I mean, they must be out there.
A couple weeks ago, or I guess at the time that this will come out, a little bit more than 2 weeks ago, Twitter lost the Krasen Bros, both of them. They were suspended for allegedly managing multiple accounts, which is, oddly enough, the same reason that Jacob Wohl was suspended, which is like their sort of analog, I guess, on right-wing politics. You spoke with them on the phone last, what was that, Thursday?
I talked to him on Saturday. No, it would have been Friday because we hung out on Thursday. And yeah. Then I was like, I'm talking to him tomorrow. So it, was, right. It must have been on Friday.
Yeah.
I talked to him. And they were suspended from Twitter May 23rd. So that was 2 weeks from last Thursday is when the music died.
Yeah. How are they? Are they in good spirits? What's the mood? What have they been doing in their spare time now that they're not telling Trump that, you know, he's been thoroughly stank on, good sir?
Yeah, so I mean, like, I was really surprised that they, like, they didn't seem like, I only talked to Brian, or I only talked to Ed, rather. My editor, I was like, I can only talk to Ed because I guess Brian was on vacation. And my editor was like, what if it is only Ed? So now I've got another conspiracy theory to wrestle with. They seemed to be, you know, in good spirits. Like, these guys are just, I don't know, like, they told me they run several investment properties. They've got a ton of websites. They wouldn't tell me what websites they own just because they were afraid that they were going to get DDoS'd. So, you know, I don't know. They seem like they're, like, fine. They're not, like, they're, like, the opposite of, like, Laura Loomer, who, like, the Krasensteins are certainly not going to chain themselves to the Twitter headquarters. They just basically seem to, like, have moved on completely. I, like, asked him, I was like, is there ever a point in your day when you, like, because sometimes it'll catch me, and I don't have my phone, I'll be like, oh, man, such a good tweet. And, and I was like, is there ever a point in your day where you, like, get that feeling, like, I should tweet that, and then you realize you can't, and they're like, or Ed was like, no, I never feel like that. And I was just like, wow. So you guys are just, like, I think Twitter's, like, one of the few things that I'm, like, legitimately addicted to. Like, I it's horrible, but I without Twitter, I'd be like a, like, what am I just going to talk to people? Like, yeah. Sounds exhausting. Yeah, they seemed like they were fine. Ed told me they run a bunch of investment properties. They're still doing their podcast. They don't sell ads on their podcast. They've got a Patreon, so you get their podcast, like, a day early if you're a Patreon subscriber. I was going to listen to one and do this story for the Daily Dot. And by the time I got around to doing it, like Splinter or Vice or somebody had already written it. And I was like, oh, all right. But yeah, so they've got a podcast. They got a bunch of websites. And they told me investment properties. So I don't know if he's like, if these guys were real estate salesmen, that would not surprise me at all. I mean, like, this is total kind of like real estate vibe.
big real estate boy hours.
Yeah, speaking of some of, like, the sleazy real estate guys I know, they've pretty similar. I mean, they've had their houses raided and stuff for scams, but the Trump, like, grift doesn't seem to be, like, particularly nefarious. Like, I don't know, they cannot have made much money on it. They say that they're not taking money from their website. They own a website called hillreporter.com, which is just an aggregation website. It's decent. They broke the story on Wall, so I mean, like, It's not like terrible, but it's just, you know, it's an aggregation site and there's nothing wrong with those, but it's hard to get traffic to it if you're only traffic driver. Like, they're not getting Drudge links. Their traffic driver was their Twitter handle. So he told me that he's lost a ton of traffic on Twitter. He said he had to cut back on some of his writers. I am not going to speculate as to like the few, I mean, there's, you know, people need jobs, so I'm not going to speculate as to like the future of what's going to come next for Hill Reporter. But yeah, I mean, like at the end of the day, like these guys didn't really make any money from like the Trump grift that they seem to have been pulling off. Like they were Bieber grifters before this, and they had like a website and stuff then. And I think that they probably sold ads on that and made money from that. But I just like really confused as to how they, what was this all for? Like,
yeah, that seems to be like the big question, because people will often confuse like big social media followings with influence. Like, could the Krasenstein bros get like 500 retweets, 1,000 retweets on something they posted? Yeah, that wasn't like that hard. But when it comes to like selling something or transforming tweets into like a profit stream somehow, that's an entirely different feat. And like you were saying, I don't know many people, if anybody, that it was like a unironic, like hardcore Krasenstein person. So I'm kind of in the same boat that you're in, where it's like, I don't think this will really hit them that hard. It seems like they were getting money from other places, but this wasn't like totally nefarious, but yeah, I guess I have the big same question as you do, which is like, what was this for? What was this about?
I don't know if they like, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, they hate Trump just as much as anybody else that replies to his tweets hate Trump. But like, one thing I was thinking about is like, so some of these people are like active, like Jacob Wall, like comes out in public and makes a fool out of himself. He doesn't just do it online. Like he goes to CPAC, and you know, we were at CPAC and we saw him, and like the Krasensteins aren't even going to like campaign rally. Like they're not like popping up in real life. They just have these mansions in Florida and they just tweet from them. So like, it's hard for me to like, it's, you know, the argument that you can make is that they did this in good faith, and you know, they want Trump out of the White House or whatever, which, you know, yeah, cool. But if they like, if you actually believe in something, like I think that maybe not all, but I think that Laura Loomer like actually believes a lot of these things, these ugly things that she believes, and she acts on them, and like she goes out and pop, when she got banned from Twitter, she chained herself to the headquarters and she popped up at CPAC and like to yell at Oliver, like, yeah. Like, but the Krasensteins don't do that. They don't go out into the world. So, I mean, like if you actually believe like that Trump sucks, you know, he did a rally in Florida not that long ago. Why not go to like the rally and like I remember the first time I saw Jacob Wall in person, I was just like, oh, finally, like this guy is not just an avatar. But them, like, nothing. Like, they never pop up in person. They just podcast and tweet, but now they can't tweet. So it's just like, I don't know. I'd be very curious to find out if they were actually Bieber fans or if that was like a big, like, did they ever go to like a Bieber concert? Like, yeah. And I tried to find out in our conversation, like, if there was anything behind it. And I like, and that, my way of doing that was kind of to try to see if I could tease out like a 2020 endorsement from him.
Yeah, yeah.
To see like what like he thought about like actual politics, and he just like wouldn't really tell me. He leans to Biden over Bernie. And I talked to him about like Mueller and stuff like this, trying to get like any sort of like sense that like, you know, this guy has like a certain ideology that they practice, or that, you know, and it's just like, I don't think they're dumb. I don't think that they care, which is like, almost more admirable, probably more admirable than Laura Loomer or like somebody like that who's dumb and but cares.
Someone who's just logging on and posting shit.
Yeah, but they're just like, I mean, that's like that was like my big catching point. I was like, I don't think that you guys believe in any of this. Like, I think you hate Trump just like my uncle or whoever hates Trump and complains about it, but he's like, you're not going like to rallies, you're not like organizing. I haven't checked the FEC forms to see if the Krasensteins have donated to any 2020 candidates, but I would be very surprised to see their names pop up there. Like, it's just like, I don't know, like, if you believe in this stuff, like, wouldn't you act on it to some extent outside of Twitter? Like,
yeah, one would think.
Yeah, like, Twitter's not real life. We always say that. And just nothing. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, what comes... So, my next question was, like, what comes next for you guys? Like, Wall got kicked off of Instagram or off of Twitter, and he went to Instagram where he's like, oh, I don't know. How would you characterize Jacob Wall's Instagram presence?
I don't even know where to begin. It's all over the place.
Yeah, he always posts like...
But it's like more about him and less about politics, really.
Yeah, yeah. It's always stories with like... Oh, his story... I love watching Jacob Wall's stories. And it's just like... Jacob Wall, sex god, smokes priceless cigars. It's just like, all right, man. But like the Krasensteins haven't moved. I asked him that. I was like... Are you guys going to go to Instagram? Like, where do you go from here? I think that their YouTube presence is exists, but it's not like, you know, they're not really YouTubers. I mean, they're jacked, so I guess that counts for something. I mean, talk about swole resistance, the crest. I mean, that's something they could do. They could go to Alex Jones route and like market like
supplements. Oh my god!
I mean, tell me, you would not hit the gym with a Krasensteins pre-workout, like.
Oh man!
I mean, that would be an all like, hell yes, I'd buy it. I would buff. And your birthday doesn't come for another year, but which is a bummer because like, I'm just gonna start calling up my friends and finding out when their birthdays are and seeing if we can get the Krasensteins to market supplements. But I mean, like, that would be a decent grift as well. Supplement grift is awesome. Like, it's such an easy grift. Everybody does it. You know,
they're like tactical sunglasses.
Yeah,
that, like,
yeah.
Helps you see Trump's lies or something.
Oh my god, yes! Like, so many good ideas that I would have. I mean, if you guys are listening,
yeah,
you got some great ideas. yeah. But I mean, I don't know. So I don't know what comes next for him. I mean, that was my real question. That's what. Everybody that read that article, you know, a couple of people talked to me, and that's they asked the same thing. Like, what comes next to the Krasensteins? And it's just like, dude, I don't know. Like,
yeah.
I was talking to one of our friends about it the other day, and I was like, I would not be surprised if these guys pop up. Like, the Firefest guy is going to pop up. You know he's going to pop up again in a couple of years. Some scam he's got. You know, he's scamming people out of credit cards or something. And these guys, I think these guys are going to pop up, but it's going to be in a circle outside of ours.
Yeah. Yeah, I like, can see them reemerging, but outside of politics.
Yeah, they're going to, like, really help K-pop come to the U.S. They're going to be, like, the Gordy Berry of, like, K-popers. Or Barry Gordy.
Doesn't the K in K-pop stand for Krasensteins?
Yeah,
anyway?
I mean, like, I don't know. I mean, the other thing is they weren't upset about being kicked off Twitter. I was like, are you guys, like, super angry? Are you, like, going to sue Twitter or something? And they're just like, nah.
Like, it's chill.
It's over. And I was just like, wow, man. Just like the like it was really disappointing because I really wanted them to be like, I mean, the other problem is that they don't talk like in real life like they do. I mean, they do on their podcast, their We Love the FBI stuff, but like, yeah. I wanted to like get him going in the conversation. I wanted him to say boom out loud. That was what I really wanted, because that's like his like catchphrase on Twitter. If you miss that era, he would just go like boom. Trump indicted. Now I don't know. I mean, it's a bummer, man.
Twitter might never be the
same. They seem a bit darker. No, I had them both blocked, actually, so I wasn't that worried about it. I ripped one of their tweets, and they reported me, and so I was just like, dude, what the fuck? Yeah. So I blocked them both. Thankfully, there is one Krasenstein left on Twitter.
Ken
Klippenstein. The last great Krasenstein.
When I asked Ken like what he thought about the band, he was like, I just hope people stop making this joke now. Like, it's funny and like he's in on the joke, but also like it does, like occasionally people are like, oh yeah, I wanted to retweet your story, but I thought you were one of those Krasenstein guys.
Oh man, so, that's the worst.
And I like felt kind of bad about that.
No, I mean, Ken's an incredible reporter, so, but you're right, it's such a good joke. Like, some of our right-wing friends that we joke about being Antifa, like, it's like such a good joke, it's such a bad joke, but everybody makes it. Yes, I don't know what comes next, man. I really, if you have any idea, if you, like, I don't know if you should reach out to me, but if you, like, bought a house from these guys at some point or something, and you're listening... I mean, yeah, give it to me, but it's like
Hail Mary right here.
I mean, like, at some point, like, these guys, I'm telling you, man, somebody has a great story to tell about these guys. The interesting thing about them too is they reinvented their Twitter accounts a couple times. So at one point they said when they were like a Bieber account, they had like 200,000 followers.
So they had big accounts to begin with.
So they apparently had big accounts before they pivoted to Trump. But yeah, so I don't know what comes next for these guys. I hope that they stay online.
Well, Alex, it's been great talking to you, getting that tactical update about the Krasensteins. Where can people find you and the work you're doing?
My Twitter handle is just AlexThomasDC. Not really that exciting.
Really selling it, man.
But no. Yeah. Most, you know, like I said, my day job is for I'm a Washington correspondent for Playboy. I write about super online stuff for the Daily Dot. So you know. But I mean, I've got a website up, it's just alexthomasdc.com. So people always ask me, they don't always ask me. A couple times people have been like, oh, you're at the Daily Caller, and it's like, oh, like, no, Jesus no. Christ. Because, like, I guess, like, a lot of apparently, I mean, I've got all of them blocked too, but apparently all the Daily Caller reporters have DC at the end of their title. But now, yeah, so I just, Alex Thomas DC is my Twitter.
Cool. Well, Alex, thanks so much for coming on Shitpost.
Oh, thanks. Always a pleasure.
And that's going to do us on the show this week. Thank you this week and every week for listening to Shitpost. Let's get out of here. You can find Shitpost everywhere that podcasts are found. Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, CastBox, etc., etc. If you like this show, tell your friends. We're always looking for new listeners, and leave us a nice review wherever you find your podcast. You can get the newsletter, bonus episodes, and everything else at shtpost.substack.com. I'm your host, Jared Holt. The date is June 10th, 2019, and I'm signing off. Peace out.